This afternoon is entitled What More Do We Need to Understand? It's a facilitated session, and we're fortunate that Ross Matsueda from the University of Washington has agreed to facilitate. He looks very facilitator-like there. And we'll turn it over to him. We're going to have, I think, short presentations and then a group discussion.
So this session is called What More Do We Need to Understand? But because the presentations were so good earlier, I think we know everything. And so we can dispense with this session and go have a cocktail and happy hour. No? Okay. One of the things, I think one way of thinking about this is that there are huge constraints in resources. I heard that we have maybe two or five questions, cordially, and so we can't do everything. And a lot of the presentations, our discussions have been sort of like, well, let's think about doing everything. And I think that's a very, very important thing to do because it allows us to make informed decisions. So we know that if we don't do X, then there's going to be a cost associated with it. We won't be able to make certain kinds of inferences, et cetera. So what we'd like to do is I'll give our participants 5 minutes to discuss, and then we'll go through the questions that were listed in the program. And they are, one, consider the causal components of criminal justice involvement on health, which I think is maybe the biggest question that confronts us, and we need to know the limitations of the kinds of causal inferences we can make. And the issues have come up in the discussions. What's the appropriate comparison group? Are we doing causality? And I can see a number of issues that we should discuss here. One is just what kind of causal statements are we trying to make? What is the counterfactual? Are we really after treating incarceration as a treatment? And if so, what is the counterfactual condition? Now, ideally, one would think that it would be, in a perfect world, it would be the exact same person at the exact same point in time. We assign them to incarceration, and then we also, at the same time, assign them to non-incarceration. The question is, well, what is that status? And so, for example, it could be probation if someone is already offended. That is the ideal, and I think it's useful to start with that and then think about how close can we get to that in the actual data that we would be collecting and then analyzing. So selectivity and appropriate comparison groups is one element here. Another one is treatment heterogeneity. A number of speakers have talked about racial differences, ethnic differences, and gender differences, but also there are differences in experience in prison, such as solitary confinement. And there's maybe treatment heterogeneity across individuals due to their characteristics, such as the concept of resilience. And then finally, with causality, the notion of mechanisms and pathways, which a number of people have raised, I think it's critically important, but the research is still kind of waiting there, it strikes me. And then I guess the spillover effects were mentioned as well, which I think is an important issue. So that's on causality. A second issue we will discuss is identify the critical unanswered questions and the data needed to explore these answers, including effective sample size. And this would include sampling frame, the particular kinds of measures, and all of this under the constraint of limited resources. And then third, discuss whether various proposals for data collection would be sufficient for the most critical end users. And Here we can, again, open it up to discussion. So what I'd like to do is have each of our panelists give 5 minutes to say whatever they want to say, and then we'll go through the questions issue by issue, and first invite the participants, the panel members, to get their 2 cents in first, and that will be followed by everybody else. So we're going to go in inverse alphabetical order and start with Ingrid.
All right. Well, I had to do slides because I'm not as good at speaking without them. And so I'm just to give you a little background. I'm a general internist. I do addiction medicine now for Kaiser Permanente Colorado. And I also do research at the and with the Division of General Internal Medicine at the University of Colorado. And I've worked with BJS. I'm sort of looking at the reverse as a visiting fellow. It's sort of looking at the reverse questions, which is how do we get health information into criminal justice data collections. So that's sort of the background which I come from in terms of this. I'm sort of a concrete thinker, so I had to like back way up here when we started this discussion to think about what we're actually talking about and why we're talking about it. So, and it seems to me like in order to select which kind of data collections or what kind of questions we have to really think through why we need to collect this information. And some of that rationale was given this morning. But let me just see if I can just spell out what I think is the problem we're trying to solve from my perspective as someone who's in health. I'm not advancing my slides. I'm advancing them. Okay, here's the questions. So basically, from my perspective as a physician, health services researcher, criminal justice populations are really the hidden population in health and public health surveillance and research. Despite the amazing work of some of the people at this table, that's still the case. They're largely excluded from most national health surveys and data collections. Unfortunately, they're yet at high risk for many very important population health outcomes, and just a few of those are things like HIV, tuberculosis, among many others, and mortality. And the problem is that undercounting means that we don't know very much about their healthcare access, their service delivery, their quality of care, and their outcomes. And I also think that there's another problem, which we haven't really touched on yet, which is that undercounting may also affect our population health estimates for the so-called general non-institutionalized population, because we're undercounting people with criminal justice involvement. That might vary by condition and probably by data collection, but I suspect that that may be an issue. So from a public health perspective, I think this is particularly important. So there's a very fragile tentative link between criminal justice data collections and health data collections, and this is sort of where, say, the data collections done by the Bureau of Justice Statistics are on the criminal justice data collections, but they haven't had a lot of integration of health, although they have had some, and so that's been great to work with. And then the health data collections haven't had great integration of criminal justice measures. And so it seems like what we need to do is strengthen these bidirectional linkages, and some of that can be done by entering questions, as we've discussed today, but it also could potentially be done by using other creative ways of trying to make administrative data linkages happen between those. And some of those could probably be pretty efficient, so I'm not sure that it's going to take, that it's always going to necessarily take a ton of effort to have better integration between these. So in terms of the why, I tried to, when I was doing some work with BJS, sort of map out at least 10 reasons why we might want to do health and criminal justice data collections, so that, because if I feel like if we don't know why, then we can't really figure out what the best mechanism is for those data collections or what actual items we need to be measuring. So these are some of the things that I came up with from reasons why people do health data collections. And, you know, CDC, for example, is one of their major functions is surveillance, and that would be measuring prevalence of disease and change over time in common conditions, or monitoring epidemics and emerging health issues. And so examples of this would be HIV, tuberculosis, and mortality. In all of these instances, obviously, criminal justice involvement is relevant and important because some of these are very prevalent in criminal justice settings. Another reason why we might want to do a better job at doing this is alignment. So what we want is here to provide corresponding data to what's available in external population so that we can make appropriate comparisons and understand where the quality gaps are. So here it would be like, and we also want to measure progress towards national health priorities in the general population, including people who have criminal justice involvement. And one example of this would be cancer screening rates, looking at both incarcerated people and people who are outside of incarceration or outside don't have criminal justice involvement. Other reasons are for policy reasons, and those have come up today. So we want to address emerging policy questions like the impact of the Affordable Care Act on highly vulnerable or high disparity populations. Another is health equity that might guide our data collection and interest in health equity. And it sounds like that's been a major interest in gathering us today here, where we might want to measure variabilities or disparities by race, ethnicity, gender, geographic location, et cetera. And an example of this would be looking at differences in death rates by race or by incarceration status or by prior incarceration status. So a couple others, and I won't go into any of these in depth, but our other principles that might guide our data collections, and one of those would be prevention. So this is very dear to my heart, is just the measure to the delivery of preventive services, and that hasn't really been done much in criminal justice population, so such as vaccination coverage compared to the general population. Another might be patient-centeredness. I'm pretty sure that this is of interest to Emily. and this is really where we measure the provision of care that is respectful of, based on IOM definition, respectful of and responsive to individual patient preferences, needs, and values. I don't know that we've done much of this at all with criminal justice populations. I don't think we know anything about whether the care we've delivered in criminal justice settings meets any of these individual preferences. And these would include items such as patient satisfaction, patient participation in decision-making about healthcare decisions, and so on. Transparency is another reason, and that's aligned with, I think, some White House priorities around transparencies. This is really just to provide the public with information and have accountability and active public participation and collaboration. And then another reason we might want to collect this kind of, or, you know, this interface of data would be operational reasons. And so, for example, at Kaiser, this is very important. We want to have data that can guide operational decisions about healthcare delivery. And I know that's of interest to correctional healthcare providers and administrators. They want to make sure that they're providing care that meets, to the extent possible, the actual priorities and needs of their population that they're serving and treating. Then there's performance and value. So this is quality of care issues. Is the care guideline concordant? Are we having good value for the care that we're providing based on an equation between costs and outcomes? And then finally, the last principle is human rights and legal issues. This is where we want to make sure that that rights are being respected, the constitutional or legal mandates are being met, and that there's no egregious events happening, such as some of those that we heard about this morning from Glenn Martin. So those are just some of the examples, because I think I thought that might be helpful to sort of frame the discussion about what specific measures to make sure that we align that back to why we're collecting the information and what the values are that are guiding our decisions to collect that information.
I think I want to use my time to return to the question, the issue that I raised first thing about, you know, when we're thinking about treatments, it's always compared to what. And I want to do this in the context of the work that Holly and John presented, which I really was impressed by. I'm going to frame this in the following way: I wasn't aware of that work. And so I wasn't a reviewer of it. But had I been a reviewer, I'm sure I would have recommended its publication. But I also want to talk about things I would have pushed them on. And I want to relate it to policy issues, the policy issues. And as a backdrop for this, one thing that's clear from this entire discussion is a backdrop for this thing is that people are thinking in terms of we have too many people not only in prison, but we have particularly have too many people in prison who have mental health problems, and what are the ways of of getting them out. So I want to frame it in those terms. So Holly and John looked at one part of their treatment was being sent to jail or prison. And the next part was, well, compared to what? Well, I guess the alternative to being sent to jail or prison is some combination of the following for the other people in the sample, is being convicted but not incarcerated, being arrested but not being convicted, or not being arrested at all. And so that the comparison the treatment effects you measure are jail and prison versus some unknown combination of those other alternatives. And so I want to think about what the policy, therefore, what the policy implications are, of the fact that we, don't know specifically what combination of the alternative is. So I'll begin by making a comment which I made earlier today, which didn't seem to be real popular, but I'm going to still say it again, is that for very serious crimes, things like robbery, sexual crimes, murder, I would say that your analyses there are not telling us anything that is useful from a policy perspective, because if you commit those crimes, at least in Pennsylvania, the judge has no alternative but to send you to prison. And that's true in the United States. But the fact is, is that most people are incarcerated for far, far less serious crimes where there are, alternatives. And so in the case of what I'll call marginal felonies or serious misdemeanors that are the targets of so many diversion programs, it seems to me that understanding how jail or prison compared to conviction but no incarceration, knowing what that treatment effect is the interesting alternative, because it's going to tell us, because that's the kind of treatment, that's the alternative to incarceration for those classes of people. But then sort of digging down further is there are also large numbers of people who are incarcerated for very non-serious or even summary offenses, or even, it's not even being convicted. It's like we're using our jails and prisons as debtors' prisons. And so for them, it seems like the interesting alternatives are things like not even arresting them in the first place. Why, or not even bringing them in. And so understanding there what the treatment effect is relative to no intervention, or at least no criminal justice intervention whatsoever, is a really interesting thing to learn about. So that's my pitch for why it's so important to get much better data on what the treatment alternatives are, and to think about this just like when you do a clinical trial. The control and treatment are well defined. So so you're asking, if I do this relative to usually status quo, medical practice, what's the gain? So that's the comparative. I would also say that another important data need, which I think is implicit in what Emily and Josh have been pushing, is that we have to have better information on what kind of health care these people are receiving under both treatment options. And particularly in the case of the non-incarceration alternative, I'll just remind you of a comment that I made, is the treatment alternative the kind of health care that everybody in this room is getting, or is it the kind of health care that most people who wind up, you know, in prison and jail are getting. If it's the latter, you know, at least, as I said, for some kinds of illnesses, I can imagine they're better off being incarcerated. I mean, I don't mean that's. I'm not pushing that. And then the final comment I'll make, and then I'll make this very quickly, and we can talk about it more if anybody's interested. There's been a number of people who have talked about the importance of identifying heterogeneous treatment effects, and I agree with that. But I think it needs to go well beyond simply saying, well, is it different for men and women, or is it different for ethnic groups, or, you know, the way we usually slice and dice things? Because, you know, in health, particularly on matters of health, I mean, there can be really complex interactions that go well beyond, you know, these kinds of things that were well beyond demographic differences, and that there are really some pretty exciting new methods for identifying heterogeneous treatment effects, which are combining, you know, kind of conventional statistical methods with advances in machine learning. And I can mention that later, but I'll stop now.
Thanks, Dan.
Yeah.
All right, so I want to focus on three different words. First is age, the second is duration, and the third is spells. So for me, coming from a, I guess, very traditional demography background with lots of loving sociologists and criminologists around, certainly age is something that I would bring up first. And when I say age, and I'm thinking about, okay, what do we measure? What are we trying to actually understand? What I want to actually emphasize there are the social roles that are attached to certain ages. So if we think about what happens when someone turns into an adult, are there any additional roles that are picked up? Well, they can vote, so that certainly matters. They might be parents already. They might actually add to the household income in some way. But regardless, with the age, thinking about how people age and what kinds of roles that they accumulate once they age, and what happens with the disruption of incarceration. So with incarceration, then, let's say that we're talking about someone who is married with kids, and all of a sudden they are arrested. So what happens? Not just literally, as in what happens, sure, they're put in a police car and taken away, but what happens to them actually emotionally, and what happens to the roles that they actually play, and how do those roles either get severed, or how do they keep them intact while they're dealing with this experience of being arrested? What kind of job do they have? Is it a job that would actually be understanding of the fact that you decided not to call in because you're in jail right now? Or is it one where you'd be fired right away? So that's some of the things that I'm thinking about with age. In terms of duration, I guess I'm pulling from some quite established people like Geronimus, and maybe some not as established people that I will not name right now. But what I am thinking about is weathering the storm. So when one is incarcerated, and let's go back to thinking about those roles that I talked about and how they differ by what age you are, the experiences that you've had thus far, the roles that you have, how do you actually adapt or function? How do you actually remain a human being and cope with the fact that you are incarcerated? So in thinking about, I guess, the effects of something, why duration might matter or why it may not matter, one of the things that I think about is the weathering that takes place due to being incarcerated. And also the elimination, again, back to the roles, the severing of those roles, the longer the duration. The final thing, the spells. So the spells ties to something that I've been trying to work on for about, I don't know, let's say some months or something. And they came out of a bit of frustration for my own self. I was trying to write a paper, and I'm sure we're always trying to write some paper, and I couldn't write it because I had absolutely no framework on how to actually, I guess, put the pieces together. My intent was to talk about privilege and to think about privilege as one's experience of life and death, but also life and death as measured by whether or not you're incarcerated versus not being incarcerated. And then juxtaposing them based on age and race and talking about what happens if we give, let's see, a white male, a black male's experience of incarceration. When do they actually die then? So going back to the life tables and thinking about a double decrement life table where you can die if you're actually dying or you can die when you're incarcerated, that's what I was trying to understand. But I couldn't really get it because I wasn't thinking about it widely enough to encapture populations that actually do not experience incarceration. That not everybody experiences it, right? And some of us experience it. Okay, I haven't experienced it. That's probably why I have a job. It's a good job. All right. You can strike that from the record, though. I mean, you can say it's a good job. But in terms of proximity to these actual experiences, I think this is sort of what enables us or disables us to actually really understand the actual health effects that we're talking about today. And so, again, I couldn't figure out a way to actually frame the paper until I started thinking about it in terms that people have sort of echoed throughout the day, starting with Mike. And thinking about, okay, we have social life, we have civic life, and then we also have physical life. And when I put those three dimensions of life together, it made it much easier to try and contextualize these ideas of age, duration, and spells. So to that effect, I'm just going to give you one of my propositions of this sort of theoretical framing. Which is sort of funny just because nobody ever thinks theory when they say my name. They're like, theory? All right, that's interesting. But I'm probably not giving myself enough credit. So in terms of civic and social life, what if somebody can be born and be physically born, but actually be civically and socially still born? Such that they never, ever have chance of having a social life or an embeddedness in a social network that can actually move them, mobilize them, upward mobility. What does that mean? And if someone can be civically dead upon birth, what does that mean? And I think these are things that real people actually face. Maybe none of us in this particular room, but maybe we know people who do actually experience that. And I think that that kind of framework, or thinking about it from that framework, allows us to get past just the event of incarceration and think about people who are also experiencing very similar events, even in the absence of incarceration. That's it.
Thank you, Evelyn. So before we go to the specific topics, would anyone like to comment or ask questions for our participants so far? Yeah.
I'd ask Dan to expand a little bit on the advances in machine learning, and how I found that interesting to hear what you have.
Sure.
Think
I mean, I think that, first of all, that the thing that you have to understand about what people do who do ML are, which is very different from the kind of statistics people in this room do, they are interested in prediction. That is all they are interested in, okay? And so that they may be interested in predicting something as trivial is whether you're whether on Netflix that you know it should recommend that, you know that Michael should watch The Makings of a Murderer. You know,
it was in my class,
right? Yeah, yeah. or something you know much more important, like you know might you get some life-threatening disease, okay? And the way they do it is that if you think about this like in the context of the ad health data, and let's say is it wave four or five? Four is if you have any variable in wave four, anything, most of the variables in wave four, but anything prior to wave four is a candidate predictor, or you can interact it with anything you want. And so the net result of it is that the number of what we would call variables in a regression, what they would call features in the data, overwhelms the number of people in the data set. So there's millions of predictors, and you have, what, 4,000 people in the data set or so, or roughly, or whatever. I mean, and so it's about coming up with the combination of things that predict, you know, your health status, you know, in wave four based on everything else that's there. And so what they're doing – so it's just about prediction. But what they're doing now is asking the question, is getting back to counterfactual analysis, of trying to use ML methods to comb through the data, the treatment data, and finding combinations of people, you know, like, you know, looking at interactions of, you know, black women who were 16 to 24, you know, who went to Rice University. I mean, you know, and to see if they can find differences for that category of people, you know, in their response to treatment. So you're trying. It's kind of like in a fancy, well, much more elaborate propensity score kind of analysis. And there's been some really exciting, it was actually Susan Athey, who's at Stanford, which is one of the hotbeds of this kind of thing, and Hito Ibbins and some people in the stats department are really doing some really interesting things in which they're bringing to bear the ML methods and squarely grounding them, though, in kind of counterfactual analysis where you get standard errors and blah, 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 blah. So that, I think it's a really exciting opportunity.
Can I comment on these there things? Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I think what's really interesting is that because I'm not a sociologist or a demographer, the term treatment effect is difficult for me to absorb as a physician, because I feel like incarceration is like the treatment of last resort, right, for problems that we don't know how to solve in other ways. But there are other available treatments for most of the conditions for which we, or some of the condition, medical conditions for which we incarcerate people, such as addiction. And so it does, so anyway, that's just one thought, is that I don't quite know. I mean, the alternative is that there is effective treatments for many of the things which, including deprivation and poverty. I mean, I'm not sure how to solve those at the societal level, but, you know, for individuals, it seems like there's effective alternatives other than incarceration, and incarceration should be the last sort of resort item. And then even if it does improve or have some positive effects on some individuals, it almost seems, or protect society from others, it seems like that should be, again, like the very, very last resort. And I really like this idea of sort of civic and social life as an outcome that may be just as, or maybe more important than some of the health outcomes we think about, like mortality even, because, and this concept of sort of those being a still life, because it is possible that we see beneficial effects on certain outcomes that relate to health and mortality, but without sort of civil and social engagement, and ethically it's so problematic to sort of use incarceration as those to try to address some of those. I don't know. I'm not sure I'm making any sense, but
let me just try. I mean, I think that is that sort of the, I think the cultural history, I mean, in terms of the culture of, you know, in the social sciences of calling these things treatment effects, is this is my speculation about what was going on. There's a long history, you know, going back of you know, people running regressions, you know, and saying, well, finding different kinds of associations and interpreting them, you know, as, you know, causal reflection of causal effects. And, you know, a group of a combination of econometricians and statisticians, and particularly this is coming from the statisticians, people like Don Rubin and Paul Rosenbaum, who I had the great fortune of working with, said, whoa, let's think about this, these things in terms of, let's think about these data, and suppose we were going to try to analyze them and think about them as an experiment, okay? And what are the conditions that are necessary for us to make an inference that they're, that being sent, you know, to jail reduces your, you know, has a deleterious effect, you know, on your health? And to sort of say, and what they mean by that is they're making a statement that compared to not sending groups of people to jail, there is this, quote, treatment effect. So it's, so without putting any values on it, just, it's like, just, you know, is this treatment effective or not treatment effective? And that's, I think, is the history of the way this language, you know, evolved in the social sciences, is to try to put a brakes on people sort of reflexively running regressions and saying, oh, I've measured a causal effect.
Right. The only policy risk is just that, you know, because of some of the positive effects that we've seen, you know, interpretation of those is difficult. That's the only thing. I grant you that.
I was just.
Yeah. So I think we just need to be cautious in how those might be interpreted, because it is the last resort, I guess.
Right.
So.
Other questions?
Ingrid, I'm glad you mentioned treatment for addiction, because I think, you know, we heard Glenn's story this morning, and, you know, that's one kind of trajectory. But a lot of the patients I've worked with over the years have addiction and have, and particularly with opioid addiction, you know, that the triggers and the desperation to fill that receptor on a daily basis, on a every 8-hourly basis, you know, necessarily results in people getting involved in the criminal justice system and really often interferes with the optimal treatment. And yet we have, you know, highly effective medication-assisted treatment that works. And for this particular population, it seems obvious that locking them up is not helping at all, and it's not, you know, the outcomes are far worse than the treatment that we have available, and in particular, the risk of overdose is so much higher, as you've documented in your work, immediately after incarceration. So, in fact, I would say that incarceration is, you know, probably the worst thing you can do for somebody with this particular disease. I'm wondering if, you know, somewhere we could add a question about overdose in some of these, because I think that is, you know, that we are having an epidemic right now. And so if there is, to the extent that any of these national databases can look at that, can capture that, can look at the intersection between opiate dependence, overdose, and incarceration, that is going to be important to look into. The second thing I wanted to just throw back is I loved your 10 points about how to use the data, and they seemed kind of almost more generic point, I mean, wide-ranging, but I'm wondering if in the context of, you know, an epidemic of incarceration that we know, I mean, I think I'm making an assumption that we are doing far worse by incarcerating so many people that we need to drive that down, and drive that down in a way that's going to be practical from a political and public acceptance standpoint, but also sort of maximize the beneficial effects and minimize the detrimental effects. So I wonder if we should go through your 10 points and think about them with that basic assumption.
Other comments? Yeah, John.
This for Evelyn. Just thinking about your kind of the incarceration experience, civic life, social life. A lot of our discussion today has been focused on getting better measures of incarceration or even more broadly criminal justice involvement. Would you offer an alternative strategy? And if so, what would it look like?
I'm all for better data. So one of the things that I sort of left out of this was that there is a relationship between incarceration. If we think about the carceral world as a social institution, most of our primary social institutions actually can contribute positive to our life and or have positive products. And sometimes those products are negative. But for the most part, if we think about polity, religion, family, education, government, there's some good that can come of that. But in terms of the carceral institution, we get basically two products. We get people who are current inmates and we have former inmates. And so for those with those products and thinking about how they actually sort of, I guess, reframe what those actual primary social institutions can do and what the people can do, that's sort of where I'm sort of coming from. Sort of trying to actually intersect the carceral world and think about the different outcomes. So when I was talking about social and civic life, I was thinking about it in the context of someone who has either been formerly incarcerated or is currently incarcerated. Now, currently incarcerated, only in two states are you by any means somewhat civically alive, right? But there are people, and I would imagine that most people who are actually experiencing incarceration, we know they're coming from a select population where they probably were already somewhat civically close to death, somewhat already close to this social death. And so I guess the argument that I'm trying to make here is that within some of our surveys, we already have some measures of this idea of social embeddedness or civic engagement. And so the question then becomes is, okay, well, what incarceration variables actually help us to sort of, I guess, parse out what the incarceration additive is? So I would hypothesize that the more times, the more spells that someone actually circulates through the criminal justice system and then the free world, the closer they are to being socially and civically dead. And in so much as social and civic death certainly affect one's own livelihood, that also would also lower or increase bad health outcomes and increase the probability of physical death or deterioration. So all of this, for me, is connected to health and death, which death is basically the absence of life, so therefore it is the absence of health, period. And I just want to sort of think about these things in the context of already sort of great surveys that could be possibly made even greater if we think about just this thing on a broader sort of level. So spells, duration, experience, actual in the carceral world.
So Evelyn, thank you for that. And that is a great teeing off point to my question. And, you know, the topic for this panel is what more do we need to understand? And my question would be, what more do we need to understand that we could answer using an HHS survey? And so, you know, just, you know, the idea and the vision for HHS for having this workshop is really to come up with some ideas for questions that we can use in an HHS health survey, keeping in mind, you know, that the populations that are included in our surveys are non-institutionalized. So, you know, they probably might not be the people that are at greatest risk for incarceration, or just keeping in mind who the actual population is, who we would be asking these questions, also understanding that these are general health surveys. So, you know, we're probably not going to be able to get at treatment effects or some of these very specific things. But what we can do is say, you know, there are individuals who have some type of criminal justice experience. And with that experience, how is this a indicator of health status? How is this a social determinant of health? And so when you think about reports that we produce, like Health US, the National Center for Health Statistics produces, and the statistics that you see in those kind of documents where we can show this percentage of the population has diabetes or this percentage of the population has hypertension, it's self-reported. So these are generally surveys that an individual is completing on behalf of themselves, and or they could be the proxy for someone else, but they are. So for someone who is completing a survey for themselves in a general health purpose survey, just thinking about it from that context, how could we get a measure of criminal justice, some type of an exposure variable? And, you know, the type of influence that we're going to have at this point, you know, to start getting at, well, we would want to know these other things about individuals who do have a criminal justice experience. Like, we want to know if you, like, for example, like overdoses, we might not be able to get, unless the survey is already asking those health questions, that's probably not the kind of recommendation we're looking. I mean, I know I'm saying recommendation loosely because I know that's not what we're doing here. But in terms of if we were thinking about questions, it isn't necessarily the content about the health perspective of someone who has a criminal justice involvement, but how do we even know who they are? Because then we can start to look at some data on this population, and then it's a starting point. Like, there's, we can build from that, but we just need a good starting point in thinking about how to ask that.
So one of the things that you just brought up was that you can have proxy people. So if we're thinking about incarceration, whether it be jail or prison, if you're asking, you could ask a person, the head of the household, let's say, with NHANES, NHIS, right? Is there somebody who was living in your household who is now currently incarcerated? Or so that is a very sort of simple question. How long do you expect them to be incarcerated? Those kinds of questions, I think, get at, well, they get at the fact that you can't ask a person who is incarcerated whether or not they're incarcerated because you don't survey them. And you can also, I guess, over time actually sort of look at how good a job people we're doing in terms of people actually answering that question honestly by juxtaposing the actual weights that you have in your survey, and then looking at the actual current size of the jail and prison populations.
So the, I guess a follow-up question to that, thank you, would be, so if you were to ask, like, an adult, is there someone in your household who is incarcerated, do you, are there data that would show that as an adult, having someone else in your household would impact your individual health? So if we are able to only ask, like, a question or two, does it make more sense for us to, like, for adults, I'm talking about adults here, but for an adult, would it make more sense for us to look at their exposure or, like, the household exposure? And these are things that we can, you know, talk about for the remainder of the workshop, but just thinking about if the health data that we have is for that individual for the most part, then what do we want to collect from that person?
So with that person, yes, I think you can ask them about their prior experience. Again, number of spells, duration. But, I mean, one of the things that has certainly been brought to this conversation is the impact on other people. So familial incarceration in general, or talking about what does it mean to have a mother who is incarcerated or has been incarcerated. So to me, those are the kinds of sort of really sort of quick, simple questions one could ask. But I'm sure there's more. I don't really know.
So this question is kind of one of the last questions, which is what kinds of data do we need? But since we're on the topic, why don't we just open it up to everyone just to particularly those who've had experience creating surveys, analyzing surveys, to give some recommendations about this particular question, which is, if we only have three or four, you know, items that we can put on a survey, what should they look like, going from best to worst?
So I'll wait for the mic. Sorry.
She's learned here.
Thanks. So one thing, kind of based on what I had mentioned earlier about the potential matching of administrative records to survey records, one thing my experience doing this with fragile families has taught me is that there may be questions we could ask that, A, would get us consent to link to administrative records, but would be complements rather than replacements to those records. Mm-hmm. So if we wanted to know, for example, what crime somebody had been convicted of, we might not want their best recollection of what's in their record if we ask them something like, what states have you been arrested in, and would you give us consent to look up the kind of outcomes of those cases. We could get a lot more information on duration, on kind of, on pretty much all of the things, Evelyn, that you had mentioned, on duration, on spells, and we could get it from at least a more authoritative source. And again, with all the caveats I had put in place before, there may be some way that we can create a synergy instead of thinking of it as an either-or data collection method. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's a great suggestion, particularly if we only have two questions. One would be, have you been what states have you been in, and do we have consent to go to those states? But do other people must have other suggestions for collecting these data?
Chris.
Yeah, I think one thing that struck me with Wendy's presentation in particular is that we really need to disaggregate the jail and prison experience and to talk about incarceration. I mean, and I'll out myself, I've been incarcerated, but I was never imprisoned. And I know others in the room have as well, where it's just a speed bump to do a few nights in a sleepover in a county jail. It's no picnic, but it doesn't have the trajectory altering life course effects and or necessarily the profound impact. Your risk of suicide goes up, your risk that you'll be victimized, particularly if you're incarcerated as a child. But this any jail or prison time is useful. It's useful in like a life stress calendar that we ask, among other things, did you get divorced? Were you ever in jail or prison? That's useful. But in terms of understanding these effects, at least I would like to know, be able to, from the question that is asked, be able to kind of pick that up. And it could be a duration question. We know, you know, the duration of stay matters to some extent, but that's hard to recall, you know, for folks. So, so I'm not sure. I'm not going to suggest any wording, but I think getting at that is going to be really key.
So, I understand the distinction between jail and prison, but my understanding is that, given overcrowding in prisons, there's more time that people are spending in jails. And jails, and you might have been the one who told me this when you were at Bowling Green giving a talk, is that jails don't have the programs in place to serve families and
you
all
threw
the
it right back at me, Wendy. Right, so just like last week.
Yeah, I learned. See, I actually listened to what you said. Yeah. And so they don't have the programs in place. It really struck me to handle the volume that's coming in, and that jails are in some ways replacing prisons. And so I'm not sure, as a marker of risk, and some people have said that, even talking to other criminologists, that just, you know, a few days in jail can really make it have a quite negative trajectory on your economic well-being and put you in debt, and you could lose your job and all these other things that start falling out of place. So I guess I'm just curious if really it's important to distinguish those two, or is it more of a duration measure, which I think Candace or somebody else had mentioned earlier, that shows you the length of time and would have be a proxy maybe for seriousness, and I'm not sure.
I mean, I just respond briefly that I think the you're absolutely right, and the thing that I'm getting at is that jail is an extremely common life event for young men. I mean, I think Bobby Brame says 49% by age 23, I believe. Somebody can correct me if I'm not right. Will have experienced arrest, and many of those will be jailed. What's that?
I think it's
small. So it's smaller going.
I mean, not 40-something.
I think 49% will be arrested. Yeah. So, but the point is simply that if you take the big net there, you're going to have a much different health effect than if you take the smaller net. Even if the conditions of confinement are worse than the jail, which I would grant often.
I go back to something Emily said earlier, that I think the discussion about data has to start with the starting point. And I think in terms of HHS, I mean, it seems to me that incarceration in prison, recency, duration is a good starting point for beginning to sort this out. Then we work down to jail, probation, what have you, because I think that it's a beginning, not an end, of a conversation. And to be able to document, and I take a lot of what Mike's presentation, big, longitudinal, causal. But I think this is really an area where we need to almost go back to what I would call descriptive criminology. What do we know about the prevalence? What do we know about the impact? And so I think starting small, not saying that we're going to answer all the questions, because I think, Wendy, you may be right that 2 days in jail for some could have a change in trajectory. But I think given the numbers in terms of prison and given the numbers in terms of length of sentence, it seems to me a good starting point.
Ross, you're managing it.
Yeah. Just from a survey methodological point of view, I think it's a lot easier to ask how long you've been there than to try to ask a respondent to tell us if you were in prison or in jail. I think I'm not sure how to define it for a respondent. Maybe some others do.
I guess if I'm trying to get concrete for you, because I know it's tough. And I guess if I were asking, one of the questions I'd really be interested in is, what's your current status? Like, are you currently on probation or parole under some kind of supervision status? I guess that would be my starting point. And then back up, if there was space, to find out, have you recently experienced a transition in care that involves a correctional system? Because to me, the most important thing is a sort of in terms of the healthcare issue is transitions in care, because each of those is associated with a risk, whether or not it's criminal justice transitions or any other kind of healthcare transition. But this is a major healthcare transition for people who are very high risk and have a lot of vulnerabilities in terms of their health. So I would sort of want to know about the recency of transitions. Those are just my wish list. But I think the other two things in terms of surveys, I guess my other questions would be, what are the opportunities for data linkage, which that's already been brought up. What's the opportunity finding out for vital status, which is, I guess, under NCHS, and is there any way to add something about the setting of death? Or I don't know if that's a possibility, but, in terms of that's another option in terms of did it occur under some kind of supervision or in a facility? BJS does collect some of that information, but there could be other ways that could be collected. And then the other thing I would have is in terms of anything that has to do with a healthcare contact or ending a healthcare contact, such as discharge from the hospital, discharge from the emergency room, were you discharged from a facility, or did you return to a facility that was a correctional facility? Those would also offer sort of these efficient ways of collecting information about this. Or then finally, the questions, was this test done
in a correctional facility, or was this service delivered in a correctional facility is another way of getting at some of these. So those are sort of some other thoughts about potential possibilities.
So I think that means I already asked consent. You give consent to vital records and Social Security numbers and linking. I think they already get linkages consent. I just don't know how much more. So at the Census Bureau, they get a consent that we're going to link yours to whatever we can to evaluate the state of the properties. So if the Census Bureau had all the crime records of people, they could link it and evaluate it. So I think NHANES, I'm reading your consent thing that you have to sign, says that you're going to link to other things. I just don't know if you just need to add BJS in there and then add that. What you don't have is the people who are incarcerated at a particular point in time in their health care. And that's, I think, from what I hear, that's a bigger issue that we don't have until at all.
But BJS does a survey of people in prison.
I wanted to, build on John's point, but also just, obviously I've kind of had a pushy opinion here, which is, right now, lower hanging fruit. This is what we have, a few questions, if at all, and this is an amazing opportunity. But I wanted to ask the group a question, which is being raised by Dan's point and kind of thinking about this treatment effect. And some of the things that I've been able to use is within NSDUH, there is a comparator where you can look at arrested as compared to their categories are arrested, parole, probation. And is that, would the group kind of roll their eyes at a comparison as such? That if we were to first ask, have you been arrested, ever or recently, and then compare that to the population that is incarcerated. So that's one first question. And then a comment, which is similar to what Ingrid said, NSDUH, and I think NHANES would have this opportunity. So NHANES does ask great questions on food insecurity. And one way you could, bulk stiffen up the kind of information that we might collect on collateral consequences or lifetime consequences is asking questions about if they have bans on food stamps. So there's ways embedded that you already measure social determinants of health that you can then get at how the criminal justice system is there and adding to complications like food insecurity, housing insecurity, employment. So comments and then a question for the group that if would that be a sufficient kind of comparator. Would you roll your eyes at it? Because it's not getting at criminal behavior. It's not getting at kind of, I think that there are ways that you can get at that. People use illicit drugs. They do ask questions about that. That can be a comparison. People that are using illicit drugs as compared to those who are incarcerated, and you would presume maybe for those, the illicit drug use, we wouldn't know that specifically, but would that be a possibility? And so, because that might be on my one of five questions.
Work on national survey on health. I'll be talking a little bit more about that tomorrow. We do have a ever arrest question, and then there are other subsequent questions that feed into that. But one thing I want to bring up is I think following up what Ingrid was saying about recency is most of the questions we have deal with the past year. Mm-hmm. So when you're trying to link questions about have you ever been arrested? Well, ever arrested? That's ever. But the questions about have you been arrested and booked for a particular crime, mm-hmm. They're all past year, and we have specific crimes there. Mm-hmm. Then when you want to try to link it with other questions, most of the other questions that deal with the type of information you're interested in, like events like a serious mental illness, have been in treatment, they're all past year. Mm-hmm. We have a bunch of questions that are based on DSM-4 that looks at abuse and dependence, they're all past year. So I guess one question I'll have is that a useful measured because we're dealing with past year for the most part.
Okay, I just have a quick question and then a comment. So my question is a point of clarification since I'm coming to this group very new, and that you're all talking about 2, 3, 4, or 5 questions. Now, I'm presuming that's because of length of time. Right, like the time to ask.
Real
estate. Okay, so what we have to remember is that depending on the kind of question you're going to ask, once half of your population or more is going to drop out immediately. So I'm not really sure why you're just confining yourself to necessarily a certain number of questions, because once you've asked a basic question and somebody says no to it, you're not going to follow on down the path with those people. So they're out. So your time is very different.
Right.
I just want you to think about that when you're thinking about how long, when you add a question to a survey, how long that really takes.
I guess I would just say that, you know, tomorrow our survey staff can talk about that because, you know, if you were doing a survey, like in a research setting, and you'd have skip patterns, that's different in terms when you're thinking about resources than a national survey that's an in-person household survey. So I would say that, you know, it is important to keep that in mind in terms of the number of questions, and even one question is still,
I do national in-person surveys. Yes. So again, it still comes down to the same thing, in the sense of if you're asking somebody anything, you know, whatever the question is, and they say, no, I don't do that. You know, do you play basketball? No, I don't play basketball. And you want to ask all sorts of questions about basketball. Well, you don't ask the person who says, no, I don't play basketball, any more questions. They're out of that completely. So it's the time, it's the length of time that interview takes. I know it's in person, but it's still the longer the interview, right, the more the expense is going to the person's house or going to wherever you're going to interview them, whether it's prisons or elsewhere. But it's still, if you've got a one or two questions that a lot of people can answer, then you can delve into more of the kind of information that you want to try and get, and you're not using up
So, yeah, so I guess what I'll just say is tomorrow morning we have our survey experts and data producers here, and I think that they are better suited to answer that question, and so and a few of them are here today, so they can talk about it more tomorrow.
Hi, I'm Ann Person from BJS. Specifically for the PNP, the probation and parole questions on the NISTA, we are working with NISTA to look ahead of their redesign in, 7 years, something like that?
In the 20s.
What we want to do is add, for people who do answer yes to probation or parole in the past year, a module at the end in the next couple of years that would go through a series of questions to figure out, I think it's like 3, 5, and 8 minute different modules to see and ask questions about risk and family and social engagement. And so we are thinking of that. In terms of, in terms of the death certificates, we have actually talked to NCHS about the possibility of getting a change to the national death certificate to say that the person died in a correctional facility. I'm guessing that's going to take a little longer because it's national. And so it would be a pretty big change on their form. But maybe we can do that now. In terms of linkage, and Jim Lynch is going to talk about a lot of our efforts tomorrow, we do get some Social Security numbers. It's really hard. These are not, most states don't bash their data sets against the SSA data set. So we don't actually know if these are good Social Security numbers or not. We're actually looking at that right now. I will say that about BJS data collections, these are all voluntary, okay? Nobody's required to give us their data. And so we walk this very fine line between keeping our data providers happy by not releasing their data. And in the past, people have misused our data that they gave us, and they've threatened to pull out. So we release a de-identified data set, but a lot of the things that are being talked about, there is, you know, a question of privacy. Currently, we're fielding the survey of prison inmates. We are asking each inmate to opt into linkage to their criminal history record for the next 5 years, and linkage to other external administrative records. And that's going very well. Most of them are saying yes. But again, that's the first time we've actually done that, and we've talked about consenting to linkage. So those are, you can ask me if you have questions.
I have a question. Are there health measures?
In the survey of prison inmates?
Yeah.
Yes. And if you want, send me an email, and I will send you the instrument. We have gone through and done a redesign of the mental health, so it's the K6. But we also have the physical health measures. So I can send you the instrument.
Yeah. Great.
A question. This is getting back to Emily's plea for getting basic physiological measures. Are you doing things like getting their blood pressure and their heart rate and kind of thing?
No. So it is self-report. Now, I've been to a couple of meetings where, you know, people are saying, can't you go in, can't you get, blood pressure and that, and height and weight, besides self-report. Again, we are somewhat limited in what you can do in a facility. We sample across all facilities. I know we have several supermaxes that got into the frame this time. The question of whether or not we will actually be able to interview a supermax prisoner is probably moot. They're not going to let us do it. So, again, we have to walk, we have to tiptoe. We're relying on their
Just as an aside, it seems to me that asking somebody to allow you to take their blood pressure and pulse is a lot less intrusive than asking them, can we link everything you do after you get out of prison to your rap sheet?
You would actually have to bring in a person who is clinically able to take blood pressure. Is that correct? Or could I take a 5-minute course and do it? Would you trust me?
I will let the MD to my left answer that question.
Emily, should I answer? I think you can probably train somebody.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good to know. We are.
Pains.
I'm sorry. What?
Yeah, I think you could train.
There's a training process for measuring that NHANES does with regularity, and I appreciate kind of Anne's comments because we have definitely talked about that and kind of the limited resources that BJS has to do this, and it's amazing to have the linkage. But, you know, within NHANES, again, they have a trained team. It's kind of – there's a protocolized way that you measure blood – yeah, there's someone else that's way more of an expert than
I don't work on things, but we did do an experiment where former Haynes participants were then interviewed at home by field interviewers and people with some clinical experience, and biomeasures were taken in the home and compared to what was obtained in the mobile exam clinics, and it was really very close. Blood pressure was pretty good. Height and weight were very good. So, yes, you can train.
So I had kind of like a different thing. But, I guess the thing I was thinking about just making the sort of really practical sort of decision and was thinking about this a little bit when Evelyn was talking, but like, so if we're thinking about questions for like a big health survey, if we think we're going to get cut from like 5 to 3 to 2 to 1, maybe, like, I guess I was just curious what folks would think about this. But for me, if we only had one, knowing that somebody in your household was currently incarcerated would be more insightful in terms of understanding health disparities, thinking about sort of racial disparities in women's health, like those sorts of issues, than some of the incarceration questions where you're not able to get current incarceration on the folks who are actually currently incarcerated because they're not in the sampling frame. And then to get the information on their incarceration history that would be interesting to us is going to be like at least 3 to 5 questions. So I guess I was just curious what do folks think about that?
Chris, I'm going to jump in because I feel like we were thinking along the same wavelength. I was going to say, I know we've been talking about, what five, but the reality is that we probably won't get 5. So then you have to decide, you know, what is most important. And yes, like arrests can be very good indicators of, you know, behavior, which you can also link to health behavior and health patterns. But is that as big of an indicator on how adversely affected the family dynamic is, as opposed to someone actually no longer being in the household or not being in the household at that current time? So in terms of priority, I think that someone being absent from the household at, you know, especially at the time of the survey or within the last 12 months or even in the last, you know, 5 years is going to have a greater effect and be more applicable to what you guys are trying to study than, you know, people who may have been arrested, you know, but not convicted or maybe only gone for a day or two, you know, or three, which has an effect, but it may not have the same kind of like, you know, long-term health effect as someone being absent. I think also, and we're going to talk more about the specific surveys tomorrow, but you're going to have to remember to whom you're asking these questions and about whom, because that's going to change, you know, from survey to survey. And a lot of times, you know, if the person that's incarcerated is the breadwinner or the householder or the person, you know, taking the survey and it's, you know, self-administered, you may find greater effects on the, you know, the dynamic or how the situation changed as opposed to, you know, asking about, you know, another party in the household, a child or, you know, mother versus father. But even still, it's, you know, parental incarceration is going to be different than, you know, my grandma got locked up or, you know, my child got locked up. And so I think those are the biggest things that I just want us to kind of think about, like in terms of question priority, you know. So we can talk about modes and, you know, those particular methodologies tomorrow. But, you know, if we did only have one question, you know, or if we only had two questions, you know, like what is most important? Because all of these can tell us a lot of things in self-reporting, you know, even, you know, have you ever used drugs? Have you ever committed, you know, illegal activity without even being arrested? That's something, but we're not going to have time for that, you know, so we got to make it a priority.
I like those comments. And just to comment on Chris's thought about someone current in the household, and I just want to bring up the complexity of these households are not always are difficult to capture. And so who is in the household and who's out and when were they there? And so some of the men in some of the households are loosely connected to the household and they're living in several places. And also, are we talking about the parent, the biological parents of the children? Are we talking about the step or social parents of the children? And so I think I've been a little frustrated by some of the questions I've seen out there about, is someone in the household sort of not here who was here? And I'm like, well, when were they here and what does that mean? And so I just wanted to toss that out too as a further complication.
Yeah, I guess if I can weigh in on that. And Evelyn, you've used the NSAL data too, and so have you, Emily, and I'm sure other folks have as well. But so in the NSAL, I mean, 7.5% of African-American women say that they have a currently incarcerated household member, and about 5.1% of men do, I think. So even though the households that we're trying to look at with something like this are really complicated, we, you know, I mean, that's 1 in 12 African-American women, so that's a pretty big...
I'm not saying it's not a large number. I just think, what are you getting? Who is that? Who are those folks? Are they really meaningful people in their lives? And are you missing a lot of people who are really meaningful when you ask that question? So I think you're probably undercounting the experiences when you take that approach. And because you could have children who are supposed to be there, who adult children who might be living with you for a temporary basis, and then they're moving somewhere else for a short time. So I think, and maybe not everybody knows the acronym, which is the National Survey of American Life. And so I think that's one indicator, but I'd like to hear some other ideas beyond that.
Well, just coming back on that, they limit the question to immediate family. And so
are those, I mean, stepfathers and bio, you know, I don't understand.
Immediate family.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, in the end, I mean, I'm agreeing with you. In some ways, yeah. It's about really being well-defined question as to, and then, well, who is important? Is this person important to you?
Right.
Like, no, actually, I don't care.
I think it depends a little bit. The questions we ask depends on what we want to know. What's most important? Community effects, individual effects, family effects, because they lead themselves to different questions. And so I think that, you know, there's also a higher level consideration about what information is the most valuable given the scarcity of resources we have.
Rashida and Alexis, do you have any feedback on that particular comment?
In terms of if we want community content or the individuals or family, like what would we be interested in?
Yeah, I'm saying if you have one or two questions, if you're more interested in the community effects or family effects, you maybe phrase a question slightly different or ask a question differently as opposed to the individual effects or the effects on children, things like that.
Yeah, I would say that probably individual and family. I mean, you know, if we had, and that would be something that, you know, if we had questions that would get at both of those, and even if we had to pick to say later down the line, like, you know, if we only have time to ask individual or we can ask both individual and family, and it probably depends on the kind of survey. So there are some surveys that will get family level information. And so when it is appropriate, then it would make sense for us to have that. But in terms of community level, I'm not sure that I would put that as higher up on the priority list.
Although I personally would love to also see a question on that. And as I think to Rashida's point, that that's the kind of thing that we may not utilize that question in the near term, but maybe it's more mid to long term that we would end up maybe finding a survey that kind of a community level question could pertain to. So I think it's very helpful to eventually develop that kind of a question.
I'm just wondering, as your surveys are getting redesigned, is it possible to rotate a bit? So is it an all or nothing? So you could rotate in some questions on incarceration, other times for arrest, or rotate different types of, you know, on a yearly basis.
Yeah. I think that might be an option, but those are conversations that we have to have directly with each survey individually, especially, you know, depending on when they're up for redesign and when there's even opportunity to, you know, add questions. But I mean, we definitely are interested in doing some cognitive testing of questions, and especially, you know, depending on how the conversations from this workshop go, that would be very helpful in guiding us in some of that cognitive testing. So I'm looking forward to the remainder of the workshop and the outcomes.
Can I also add something too? And I'm glad that, Mike, I think that you mentioned this in your presentation. I think you had a bullet on your slide that talked about linking data sets, if I remember correctly. And I think I'd also like everyone to sort of keep in the back of your mind Mike's bullet, because I think that, you know, in following up to, you know, the work that Rashida we'll be doing at ASPE and OMH, we'll be working together on this. I think that wherever possible, at least from my vantage point anyway, I'll always be thinking about what are those surveys that could be paired with other surveys to magnify and illuminate whatever that question is. So if there are and I don't know if this exists, so you all have to tell me, because I know less about this area of science than those of you in the room. But, you know, are there surveys within NCHS that can be combined with, you know, what's going on with Ann is doing and Jerry, what you're doing? I mean, I don't know if there could be that coupling in terms of doing some kind of meta-analysis, but that's the kind of thing where I would love to see if there's a question that could be designed that would fit surveys that could be linked. That to me is just would be fabulous.
Going back specifically to the
specifically to the rotating, or putting questions on a survey that's being redesigned. PREA, the Prison Rape Elimination Act, we expect to show up again, which means the National Inmate Survey will go out to prisons and jails probably in the next few years. If you don't know about this, again, this is predominantly on sexual victimization while in a facility, but because it's such a burdensome survey, we were not able to do our normal omnibus inmate surveys. So what we started doing in the second and third wave was put on some modules on mental health, on substance use and abuse. If there are questions that you're interested in, I can't promise anything, but here's a good way of getting on a module that will go out to 50,000 plus inmates. Okay, so again, I don't know the actual details of when that's going to happen, but feel free to contact us. Also, we're in the very early stages of redesigning the survey of inmates in local jails that will probably go out to jails in 2019-2020 after the first wave of PREA. If you're interested in that, again, contact me. Can't promise anything, but we'll try to include as much diversity of opinion as possible.
Other final comments before we end? I think tomorrow when we hear the nuts and bolts about these health surveys, we'll be able to kind of hone in on some more specific recommendations. Thank you.
Okay, so for those of you committee members, presenters, and CNSTAT staff, we are going to dinner at NOPA Restaurant, which is at 800 F Street. So right now we're at 500, I really just said that. We're at 5th and F, 500 F Street. So it's literally just a couple of blocks down the street. We can walk there. That's probably the easiest bet because parking over there is tragic. It's right across from Verizon Center. So that is at 6 o'clock. So we do have a little bit of time. I don't know. It's not enough time to walk back to the hotel, but if you needed to go back and wanted to cab it, you know, you could make it. But otherwise, you're welcome to kind of, yeah, hang out here and mingle. Tomorrow we start again at 9 and should be done a little bit earlier in the afternoon around 3:30. So I think that is it.
Comment. I understand why you are pressing. I mean, the purpose of this workshop is to identify this small number of questions that you can add to this. But I think that I would hope that the people in the workshop summary that there would be some discussion of the need for collecting data which moves beyond what can be accomplished, with these surveys. My instinct is, and this might be wrong, because I haven't done the research here, that the people in this room have probably come close to pushing it as far as it can go, or maybe that's too strong, but that they've wrung a lot of what's in there out of there, and that that either new different kinds of data or alternative approaches to doing these analyses would be useful. I mean, I mentioned the one of linking official administrative records with on prison stays with health records. I can also imagine, for example, doing sort of regression discontinuity designs, like you have these sentencing grids, and you get people who are on one side of the grid who are incarcerated, and another side of the grid who are not incarcerated, and getting them, you can get them from sentencing records, and then linking it up in various, try to figure out imaginative ways of linking it up with health records, that maybe those are the kinds of designs that I think it would be useful for the group to brainstorm and report about some of those alternatives.
So just to clarify, the workshop summary is a summary of what happens here today and tomorrow. Nothing more. Nobody else goes and reads through this stuff and adds anything to it or speculates. So whatever you want in the workshop summary, you have to bring into your sessions here and bring up as topics.
Well, I just brought one up.
and you will be quoted, and that's what it will say.
Dan, tomorrow there's a discussion panel on alternative designs, and I'm facilitating that and following Ross's footsteps, and I noted Dan Nagin's point about, so you're good.
Well, it's, to that point then, let me just add one other question. Is there ever a chance that something like N. Haynes, where there's actually collection of biological or, you know, other physiologic measures might be done in a correctional facility as a pilot? Because I don't think, I mean, I'm speculating here. I don't think BJS has the funding to do such a thing. But I'm wondering if that would provide us a lot of information about the accuracy of self-report in correctional populations about the health conditions that they have. I mean, I'd love to know, you know, what is the average hemoglobin A1C in individuals who are incarcerated? What is, what is the true prevalence of active hepatitis C? There are all of these questions that are really basic. They're not sophisticated. They're just really simple questions that we do not have the answers to right now. And that's so difficult for us who do public health work and advocacy, because we don't know the true answers to really basic prevalence questions about health in currently incarcerated people. And unfortunately, then we can't figure out what the gaps are in care and actually act on those gaps, because we don't even know the prevalence. So we can't measure improvements in care, because we just have a total absence of information about true prevalence.
Directly to that, I hate to sound like Debbie Downer, because these are all really good ideas. I think the problem is getting sharps, blood pressure cuffs, anthropometers, all the things that you need to conduct one of these surveys into a facility. Now, I realize, obviously, these things are already there, and so maybe you take advantage of the healthcare system that is already set up within the facility. I wonder, you know, like I said, we probably won't get to interview a supermax prisoner. I don't know if at that point they're going to say, no, you can't even take blood from somebody who's maximum security. I mean, I just don't know. And I think that logistically is beyond where we are right now. I'm not going to say it never will happen. And that it, I mean, I think we would love to do that. But I think realistically, the logistics are a little beyond what we could do right now.
Yeah, I mean, having obviously seen patients in both jails and prisons, we draw blood on them all the time. So the logistics may even be a little bit easier than in some other settings, which are uncontrolled, where people may not show up for follow-up and so, you know, or for a blood test and so. So the logistics, at least on the healthcare, from a healthcare practitioner's perspective, of delivering care in prisons and jails are actually sometimes easier than in the community, because you can call people out and they come.
if maybe we would look at this as a way to partner with the healthcare providers, and instead of us actually being the primary interventionist, we have them do all of the healthcare stuff. And I don't know if that would involve a survey as well or not, just get the medical measures and go on, maybe that would be the way to do it.
Director Haynes will be here tomorrow, but just so you know, these mobile clinics that they have are like several tractor trailers that get hooked up together to form a huge clinic, and they bring people in after a household interview, bring them in for a very lengthy physical exam. And it's done in these clinics because everything is really highly calibrated. And it's because of the standards that they produce. Now, the type of thing that you're looking for may not need that level of calibration and standardization. You know that when you send blood samples to different clinics, you're going to get different results. And they've worked with these clinics, labs, so that the results are all standardized. If that level of precision isn't as important, there are many other alternative approaches to collecting biomeasures, just for your consideration, because Haines is very expensive to conduct and limited because you have to have these trailers, and they can only go, it takes them a certain amount of time to drive somewhere to set up, and then they stay there for a few weeks, and then they go to the next site, and there are, I think, three or four that they have, two or three set up at any given time, and the next one or two are traveling to the next site. So it's a very slow and plodding process, and when you think of all the prisons or other correctional facilities, that would be a huge task to undertake using their set.
All right. Well, thank you. I look forward to seeing everybody tomorrow morning.